Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann. I'll begin with a letter of recommendation. Silence brought me a community and an escape. Society maintains I am broken because of my deafness. I consider myself fortunate to have been given this ability to turn off the sound. This is a story by Sarah Novick. Every evening when I return home, I rush into my house and rip my hearing aids out of my head. No matter where I've been, the routine is the same. Sometimes I'm in such a hurry, I can't even stand to cycle through the settings on the power button, so I pop open the battery doors instead. Then I stash them on a high bookshelf out of reach of my toddler, where they stay until the next time I venture out. Taking out my hearing aids is a relief, not unlike freeing my feet from a long day in dress shoes, except the thing being squeezed is my brain. I choose to wear hearing aids in a variety of work-related or social situations, but they create a dull throbbing around the circumference of my head. For all the technological power and benefit the aids provide, lately I've found their greatest value is in the pleasure of removing them. I wasn't always deaf. I was raised in a hearing world and in a house brimming with music, when back then had a much more imposing physical presence. Records, cassettes, and CDs were stacked on the tables and shelves of every room. Stereos, boomboxes, and subwoofers lined the walls of our home office. Bookish and possessing no athletic talent, I fell into choir and musical theater extracurriculars. I was a decent singer, but more than that, my friends were there. Music classrooms had become my safe haven. It's probably why when I failed a school hearing screening at around the age of 12, I ripped up a pink slip that said as much instead of bringing it home as instructed. Like everyone I knew, I understood deafness as a deficit and considered myself a broken version of the person I had been. I was losing access to sound and to others. My hearing loss was a slow progression over the next decade. It would take even longer for me to unlearn the prevailing wisdom about the deaf world that I had internalized and learn to listen to other deaf people and myself instead. I spent my high school years trying to pass, clinging to normalcy and worrying that losing my hearing would threaten the friendships I had forged in musical spaces. When I finally found the deaf community and American Sign Language, ASL, I realized that silence didn't have to mean isolation. It could mean community, conversation, just as sound had before. Feeling low one Sunday while I was away at college, I walked into a church service and noticed a sign language interpreter in the front corner. She and the deaf parishioners signed along as the band played, making them momentarily conspicuous. I slid into the pew beside them, jangling with fear and excitement that I had found others like me. Afterwards, I introduced myself to one of the group using the halting ASL I had picked up from the internet. I don't remember what either of us said, but after months of expelling every ounce of energy trying to communicate with hearing people at school, even this clunky interaction felt like a relief. I wasn't hiding anymore, and he didn't turn me away. My poor signing skills didn't matter because he and most of the deaf people I've met since understand what it means and what it feels like to be in this body. The deaf don't believe in silence, writes the deaf poet Ilya Kaminsky in his collection Deaf Republic. Silence is the invention of the hearing. I offer a revision. Fear of silence is the invention of the hearing. I don't believe in silence as a void. It's additive, forcing me inward to engage with my thoughts without distractions, challenging me to participate in the world differently, to use my remaining senses to their fullest in ways I certainly wouldn't have if I had remained hearing. Deafness has made me a better writer. While hearing individuals use music and podcasts to sustain them through their commutes, downtime, and everything in between, I allow my mind to wander, write sentences in the air. Sometimes it's boring to be alone like this, but tedium encourages me to study the atmospheric detail in my daily life. The sheen of broken bottles and potato chip bags, and the nose wires of discarded masks in the South Philly gutters, refracting the morning sun while I walk the dog. Sometimes things I probably wouldn't have noticed when I was hearing, at least not enough to remember them, now fill a rich reserve of images from which to choose when I sit down to write. Society maintains that I'm broken and has sought to rehabilitate my ears through various devices, but I've watched hearing people stuff their ears during every waking moment, seeking the thing I already have, a buffer between the self and the overwhelming day. What I once thought was normal, I now consider a burden, to never be able to stop listening, even while sleeping. Deafness certainly presents challenges in a hearing majority world, but I feel fortunate that I've been given this ability to turn off sound. While I can't recommend deafness exactly, what I've learned to see different sensory experiences not as failures, but as instances of human diversity, to stop conflating the majority experience with superiority, to find the good in the thing that at first really scares you, should be lessons for everyone. Don't be too quick to turn up the headphones. Embrace silence, or at least some time without constant content consumption. You might even slip into boredom long enough to hear what your mind is saying. Sarah Novick is the author of the novels True Biz and Girl at War. She lives with her family in Philadelphia. And now I'll read the talk section. This pioneering economist says our obsession with growth must end. It's by David Marchese. Growth is the be-all and end-all of mainstream economic and political thinking. Without a continually rising GDP, we're told, we risk social instability, declining standards of living, and pretty much any hope of progress. But what about the counterintuitive possibility that our current pursuit of growth, rapid as it is and causing such great ecological harm, might be incurring more costs than gains? That possibility, that prioritizing growth is ultimately a losing game, is one that the lauded economist Herman Daly has been exploring for more than 50 years. In so doing, he has developed arguments in favor of a steady state economy, one that foregoes the insatiable and environmentally destructive hunger for growth, recognizes the physical limitations of our planet, and instead seeks a sustainable economic and ecological equilibrium. Growth is an idol of our present system, says Daly, emeritus professor at the University of Maryland School of Public Policy, a former senior economist for the World Bank, and along with the likes of Greta Thunberg and Edward Snowden, a recipient of the prestigious Right Livelihood Award, often called the Alternative Nobel. Every politician is in favor of growth, Daly, who's 84, continues, and no one speaks against growth or in favor of steady state or leveling off. But I think it's an elementary question to ask, does growth ever become uneconomic? There's an obvious logic to your fundamental argument in favor of steady state economy, which is that the economy, like everything else on the planet, is subject to physical limitations and the laws of thermodynamics, and as such can't be expected to grow forever. What's less obvious is how our society would function in a world where the economic pie stops growing. I've seen people like Peter Thiel, for example, say that without growth, we would ultimately descend into violence. To me, that suggests a fairly limited and grim view of human possibility. Is your view of human nature and our willingness to peacefully share the pie just more hopeful than his? First, I'm not against growth of wealth. I think it's better to be richer than to be poorer. The question is, does growth as currently practiced and measured really increase wealth? Is it making us richer in any aggregate sense, or might it be increasing cost faster than benefits and making us poorer? Mainstream economists don't have any answer to that. The reason they don't have any answer to that is that they don't measure costs. They only measure benefits. That's what GDP is. There's nothing subtracted from GDP, but the libertarian notion is logical. If you're going to be a libertarian, then you can't accept limits to growth. But limits to growth are there. I recall that Kenneth Boulding said there are two kinds of ethics. There's a heroic ethic, and then there's an economic ethic. The economic ethic says, wait a minute, there's benefits and costs. Let's weigh the two. We don't want to charge right over the cliff. Let's look at the margin. Are we getting better off or worse? The heroic ethic says, hang the cost, full speed ahead, death or victory right now, forward into growth. I guess that shows a faith that if we create too many problems in the present, the future will learn how to deal with it. Do you have that faith? Laughs. No, I don't. David, historically we think that economic growth leads to higher standards of living, lower death rates, and so on. So don't we have a moral obligation to pursue it? In ecological economics, we've tried to make a distinction between development and growth. When something grows, it gets bigger physically by accretion or assimilation of material. When something develops, it gets better in a qualitative sense. It doesn't have to get bigger. An example of that is computers. We can do fantastic computations now with a small material base in the computer. That's real development. And the art of living is not synonymous with more stuff. People occasionally glimpse this, and then we fall back into more, more, more. David says, but how would a country continue to raise its standard of living without growing its GDP? It's a false assumption to say that growth is increasing the standard of living in the present world because we measure growth as growth in GDP, gross domestic product. If it goes up, does that mean we're increasing standard of living? We've said that it does, but we've left out all the costs of increasing GDP. We really don't know that the standard is going up. If you subtract for the deaths and injuries caused by automobile accidents, chemical pollution, wildfires, and many other costs induced by excessive growth, it's not all that clear. Now, what I just said is most true for richer countries, certainly for some other countries that's struggling for subsistence, then by all means, GDP growth increases welfare. They need economic growth. That means that the wealthy part of the world has to make ecological room for the poor to catch up to an acceptable standard of living. That means cutting back on per capita consumption, that we don't hog all the resources for trivial consumption. David, you said make ecological room, which brings to mind the arguments you've made about how we've moved from an empty world to a full one. But how do we know that our world is full and that we're operating near the limits of the planet's ecological capacity? What I call the empty world was full of natural resources that had not been exploited. What I call the full world is now full of people that exploit those resources, and it's empty of the resources that have been depleted and the spaces that have been polluted. So it's a question of empty of what? Full of what? Is it empty of benefits and full of cost, or full of benefits and empty of cost? That gets to that point of paying attention to the costs of growth. David, aren't the serious difficulties that we've seen during past recessions or periods of stagnant growth indicative of what would happen in a steady state economy? The failure of a growth economy to grow is a disaster. The success of a steady state economy not to grow is not a disaster. It's like the difference between an airplane and a helicopter. An airplane is designed for forward motion. If an airplane has to stand still, it'll crash. A helicopter is designed to stand still, like a hummingbird. So it's a comparison between two different designs. And the failure of one doesn't imply the failure or success of the other. But in order to move from our present growth economy to a steady state economy, that's going to imply some important design principles, some changes in the fundamental design. David, let's say that tomorrow the United States government says it recognizes the need for ecological balance and is going to de-emphasize growth. Wouldn't every other country have to make the same decision for it to have the desired ecological effect? That's a very difficult question. If you try to enact laws for counting the ecological costs of your production in the United States, and then you enter into trading relations with other countries, that doesn't count the costs. They have a competitive advantage. They may ruin themselves in the long run, but in the short run, they're going to undersell you. This creates huge problems for the free traders, because the answer to the problem is to have a tariff to protect the U.S. industry. At one time, I would have tended to favor moving toward a global government. I don't know what changed my mind. Perhaps spending 6 years at the World Bank made me think that global governance looks like a chimera. I think you're stuck with nation states. But this is globalism versus internationalism. Globalism says to erase national boundaries. Let's have one global system that we manage globally. Internationalism says national boundaries are important, but they're not the ultimate thing. This was the philosophy behind the Bretton Woods agreements. We said we have a world of interdependent nations, which are fundamentally separate, but try to be cooperative. That's the model we're stuck with. So the best road forward is for nations to try to move toward a steady state and accept the fact that you're going to need to have some tariffs and hope that the resulting benefits are sufficient to convince other nations to follow suit. David, a lot of what you're talking about has to do with getting humanity, from individuals to corporations to governments, to accept the idea of having enough, and that constraining the ability to pursue more is a good thing. Those ideas are basically anathema to modern Western society, and especially certain notions of liberty. So what would the inflection point or mechanism be that might move people away from that mindset of more? So, how do you envision a successful steady state economy? First, back up and say, how do you envision a successful steady state Earth? That question is easier because we live in one. Earth is not expanding. We don't get new materials. And we don't export stuff to space. So, you have a steady state Earth. And if you don't recognize that, well, that's an education problem. And again, there's this heroic ethic and economic ethic. Maybe the heroic ethic is the right one, but religion's counsel is to pay attention to the cost. Don't make people worse off. David, do your religious beliefs influence your economic ideas? I'll start with the second part of that question. When you study economics, you're looking at the relationship between ends and means. You want to allocate your means so as to maximally satisfy your ends. But traditionally, economics has been with what I would call intermediate means and intermediate ends. Our intermediate ends might be a good diet, education, a certain amount of leisure, health, the benefits of wealth. We dedicate our means toward those intermediate ends. Our intermediate means are commodities that we're able to produce, food and industrial goods, education. Economics is going from intermediate means, which are limited, to intermediate ends, which economics says are unlimited. I say, let's not just talk about intermediate means. Let's ask what our ultimate means are. What's necessary to satisfy our ends, and which we ourselves cannot make but must take as given? Is there an answer to such a big question? I think there is. I learned from my old professor, Georgescu Rogan, that it's matter and low entropy energy. You need matter and energy to accomplish your physical ends. But the first law of thermodynamics says that matter and energy can never be destroyed or created. You can change its form, and all processes change that form from low entropy, useful energy, to a high entropy, useless energy. Our ultimate means are constrained by the entropy law. But is there an ultimate end? That's hard to answer. Can you give it a shot for me? I think we're all in the position where we have to try to answer it for ourselves, but I can rule out the current answer, which is that growth is the ultimate end. Now, instead of that, you could say spiritual improvement is the ultimate end. That gets you into fundamental religious questions. What is the meaning of life? Where did I come from? What's going to happen when I die? These are questions people used to think of as fundamental. Now they're marginal, unscientific. My critique of economics as it exists today would be that it's too materialistic because it doesn't consider the relationship between the ultimate ends and the intermediate ends. At the same time, economics is not materialistic enough because it also refuses to deal with the ultimate means. It doesn't ask questions about the fundamental limits of the entropic nature of the world, of matter and energy, and adapting these physical limits. Let me stick with ultimate ends for a second. What do you think the meaning of life is? Everyone has an answer to that, even if it's just a punt. But I'm a Christian. I do think there's a creator. I don't think you can say life is an accident, which is really what scientific materialism says. Neo-Darwinism has gotten a free ride philosophically for a long time. When you calculate the compound probability of all these infinitesimally probable events happening at once to generate life, it becomes quite absurd. The neo-Darwinist types say, yes, we accept that, that's mathematics. It's totally improbable that life should have originated by chance in our universe. But we have infinitely many unobserved universes. Infinitely many universes unobserved. Mathematically, it could have happened. But our universe is the lucky one. They look down their noses at religious people who say there's a creator. That's unscientific. What's the scientific view? We won the cosmic lottery. Come on. You spend a lifetime arguing rationally and diligently for your ideas. And there's real discussion happening about alternatives to an economy predicated solely on growth. But growth is still king. Is that at all disappointing? My duty is to do the best I can and put out some ideas. Whether the seed that I plant is going to grow is not up to me. It's just up to me to plant it and water it. Of course, I don't think burning the world is ethically mandated by the ultimate end, so I like to see the ideas of ecological and steady-state economics move forward. But you're asking about disappointment. I get a lot of criticism in the sense of, I don't like that. That's unrealistic. I don't get criticism in the more rational sense of your presuppositions are wrong or the logic which you reason from is wrong. That is a disappointment. Georgescu Rogan made many of the same arguments and he was also completely ignored. In his case, he had made other contributions to mathematical economics which should have given credibility to his more radical ideas, but didn't. I lacked that independent thing, so it's even more unlikely I would be taken seriously. But unlikely things do happen. Okay, here's a tip. And it's a tip from Malia Wolin, her last writing for the Times tip section. How to say goodbye. You You have to say goodbye in a way that the person will understand, says Dionne Davis, 45, of Decatur, Georgia, who has worked in child care since she was a teenager, first in preschools and for the last 12 years as a nanny. In that time, she said goodbye to a lot of children, some of whom she has cared for since birth. Choose words that honor the relationship and its context. I would never say to a child, "I'm not going to work here anymore," Davis says. I would say, "Miss Dionne is sad because I won't get to play with you every day." A goodbye should not be a surprise. Make time to talk it through, Davis says. Don't leave all the emotional processing to the moment of separation. When 6 and 7-year-old siblings Davis cared for were preparing for an out-of-state move, together they made a calendar and marked off the days until their departure. Davis asked the children to draw pictures of their future home, and she illustrated how she imagined they would look on their next birthdays. As a result, their last day felt more celebratory than sad, because everyone had time to process the impending loss. Be forthright with yourself and others about the terms of your leave-taking, whether you're moving away from your home country, separating from a spouse, quitting a job, or ending a friendship. Ask yourself, is this a forever goodbye or just the end of a specific kind of association? Partial goodbyes work if it's clear what part is over. Davis enjoys keeping in touch with children even after she's done being their caregiver. Acknowledge, however, when circumstances call for something more terminal, and be brave enough to communicate that clearly. I've stayed in difficult situations too long because of the love that I have for the children, says Davis, who is now advocating better pay and benefits as a member of the Nanny Council at the National Domestic Workers Alliance. Parting traditions vary by culture and geography. Still, separating from things that you hold dear is an inevitable part of being a human anywhere. Think of goodbyes as a key socio-emotional skill for our species. Resilience during transitions is one lesson Davis tries to teach children in her care. Things will change, Davis says. We have to learn how to grow. After 7 years, this is the last tip. Goodbye and a full-hearted thank you. The next article is entitled, "What Psychologists Want Today's Young Adults to Know." The generation entering adulthood now faces novel, sometimes debilitating challenges. Experts offer tools to navigate a quarter-life crisis. This is a story by Danny Blum. Satya Doyle Bayak, a 39-year-old therapist, noticed a shift in tone over the past few years in the young people who streamed into her office. Frenetic, frazzled clients in their late teens, 20s, and 30s. They were unnerved and unmoored, constantly feeling like something was wrong with them. Crippling anxiety, depression, anguish, and disorientation are effectively the norm, Ms. Bayak writes in the introduction of her new book, Quarter Life, The Search for Self in Early Adulthood. The book uses anecdotes from Ms. Bayak's practice to outline obstacles faced by today's young adults, roughly between the ages of 16 and 36, and how to deal with them. Just like midlife, quarter life can bring its own crisis. Trying to separate from your parents or caregivers and forge a sense of self is a struggle. But the generation entering adulthood now faces novel, sometimes debilitating challenges. Many young people today struggle to afford college or decide not to attend, and the existential crisis that used to hit after graduation descends earlier and earlier, says Angela Neal Barrett, a psychology professor at Kent State University who studied anxiety in young people. We've been constrained by this myth that you graduate from college and you start your life, she said. Without the social script previous generations followed, graduate college, marry, raise a family. Ms. Bayak says her young clients often flailed around in a state of extended adolescence. Indeed, according to a recent online survey by Credit Karma, a personal finance platform, nearly one-third of Gen Z adults are living with their parents or other relatives and plan to stay there. Many find themselves so mired in day-to-day monetary concerns, from the relentless crush of student debt to the swelling costs of everything, that they feel unable to consider what they want for themselves long-term. That paralysis is often exacerbated by mounting climate anxiety and the slog of a multi-year pandemic that has left many young people mourning family and friends or smaller losses like a conventional college experience or the traditions of starting a first job. Experts say those entering adulthood need clear guidance for how to make it out of the muddle. Here are their top pieces of advice on how to navigate a quarter-life crisis today. Take yourself seriously. Set aside time to be selfish, said Dr. Neil Barrett, who is also the author of Soothe Your Nerves, The Black Woman's Guide to Understanding and Overcoming Anxiety, Panic, and Fear. She recommends scheduling reminders to check in with yourself roughly every 3 months to examine where you are in your life and whether you feel stuck or dissatisfied. From there, she said, you can start to identify aspects of your life that you want to change. Ms. Bayak said to pay attention to what you're naturally curious about and not to dismiss your interest as stupid or futile. Maybe there is a place you have always wanted to visit, or a language you wanted to learn. Maybe you want to take up a new hobby or research a part of your family history. Start to give your own inner life the respect that it's due, she said. However, there is a difference between self-interest and self-indulgence, Ms. Bayak said. Investigating and interrogating who you are takes work. It's not just about choosing your labels and being done, she said. Be patient. Some people are still locked into the view that you turn into an adult when you're 18 and that you should be all ready to go, said Jeffrey Jensen Arnott, a researcher at Clark University who studies the psychology of young adulthood. I don't know if that ever made sense, but it certainly doesn't now. Quarter-lifers may feel pressure to race through each step of their lives, Ms. Bayak said, craving the sense of achievement that comes with completing a task. But learning to listen to oneself is a lifelong process. Instead of searching for quick fixes, she said, young adults should think about longer-term goals, starting therapy that stretches beyond a handful of sessions, building healthy nutrition and exercise habits, working toward self-reliance. I know that seems sort of absurdly large and huge in scope, she said, but it's allowing ourselves to meander and move through life versus just check the boxes and get it right. Ask yourself what's missing. Ms. Bayak also said to take stock of your day-to-day life and notice where things are missing. She groups quarter-lifers into two categories, stability types and meaning types. Stability types are seen by others as solid and stable. They prioritize a sense of security, succeed in their careers, and may pursue building a family. But there's a sense of emptiness and a sense of faking it, she said. They think this couldn't possibly be all that life is about. On the other end of the spectrum, there are meaning types who are typically artists. They have intense creative passions, but have a hard time dealing with day-to-day tasks. Ms. Bayak said, these are folks for whom doing what society expects of you is so overwhelming and so discordant with their own sense of self that they seem to constantly be floundering. They can't quite figure it out. But quarter life is about becoming a whole person, Ms. Bayak said, and both groups need to absorb each other's characteristics to balance themselves out. Stability types need to think about how to give their lives a sense of passion and purpose, and meaning types need to find security, perhaps by starting with a consistent routine that can both anchor and unlock creativity. Channel Yoda. That process of cobbling together self-understanding can seem pointless in an unstable world, Ms. Bayek acknowledged, and many young people are overwhelmed by the current state of the world. She turns to perhaps the most prototypical inspiration for staying calm in chaos, Yoda. The Jedi Master is, quote, one of the few images we have of what feeling quiet amid extreme pain and apocalypse can look like. Ms. Bayek said, even when there seems to be little stability externally, she said, quarter-lifers can try to create their own steadiness. Dr. Gregory Scott Brown, a psychiatrist and author of The Self-Healing Mind, said establishing habits that help you ground yourself as a young adult is critical because transitional periods make us more susceptible to burnout. He suggests building a practical toolkit of self-care practices, like regularly taking stock of what you're grateful for, taking controlled breaths, and maintaining healthy nutrition and exercise routines. These are techniques that can help you find clarity, he said. Don't be afraid to make a big change. It's important to identify what aspects of your life you have the power to alter, said Dr. Brown. You can't change an annoying boss, he said, but you might be able to plan a career change. That's easier said than done, he acknowledged, and young adults should weigh the risks of continuing to live in their status quo, staying in their hometown, or lingering in a career that doesn't excite them, with the potential benefits of trying something new. Despite its confusion and constraints, quarter life is typically the freest stage of the whole lifespan, Dr. Arnott said. Young adults may have an easier time moving to a new city or starting a new job than their older counterparts would. Know when to call your parents and when to call on yourself. Quarter life is about the journey from dependence to independence, Ms. Bayek said. Learning to rely on ourselves after, for some, growing up in a culture of helicopter parenting and hands-on family dynamics. But even if you're still living in your childhood bedroom, Ms. Bayek said, there are ways your relationship with your parents can evolve, helping you carve out more independence. That can involve talking about family history and past memories, or asking questions about your parents' upbringing. You're transitioning the relationship from one of hierarchy to one of friendship, she said. It isn't just about moving away or getting physical distance. Every quarter-lifer typically has a moment when they know they need to step away from their parents and to face obstacles on their own. For her, Ms. Bayek, the realization came after a breakup in her mid-20s. She called her mother sobbing in the middle of the night, and her mother offered to visit her and help her through. Ms. Bayek was tempted but declined. It felt so good to have her offer to come to my rescue, but I also knew in that same moment that I had to do this by myself. That doesn't mean you can't or shouldn't still depend on your parents in moments of crisis, she said. I don't think it's just about never needing one's parents again, she said, but it's about doing the subtle work within yourself to know this is a time I need to stand on my own. And now I'll read The Ethicist. How much should I spend to keep my elderly dog alive? The magazine's Ethicist columnist on how to do right by our pets as they reach the end of life. This column is by Kwame Anthony Appiah. I'm a 65-year-old single retired woman who has sufficient means to take care of herself, though I need to watch my budget. My 15-year-old dog has been largely healthy for much of his life. I really love him, but I can see that in the next year or two there will be hard choices about how much money to spend on his care as he ages. I grew up in a farm environment with parents of limited means. We were always kind to our animals, but they were not family members. My entire family believes in quality of life over quantity, so much so that my mom and her sisters chose quality over quantity at the end of their lives. I also have a strong practical bent, which is why I saved enough for a comfortable retirement during 35 years of working, and despite some less happy events like divorce and serious medical issues. But I know the practical doesn't always carry the day in terms of doing the right thing. My concern is not just the cost of treatment for my dog, but also gauging when his suffering is too much. I can afford to spend a fair amount in that it won't impair my lifestyle, but I'm not comfortable allocating many thousands of dollars to treatments for my aging dog. However, I am concerned with what I ethically owe this very devoted pet. What do you think is the right thing to do? And Anthony writes, many people think of their relationship with their pets on the model of their relationships with people. They speak of loyalty, gratitude, duty, and, as you do, devotion. But there's a range of opinions among philosophers and animal researchers about whether animals are moral creatures in this way, with some notion of reciprocal obligations. Some researchers make the case that there's a continuity of moral sentiments between human beings and other animals. If you can be good, though, you can be bad. And as a bad dog, the dog who chewed your Jimmy Choo's and scarfed down your Scallopini, truly bad, morally speaking. In Fellow Creatures, the philosopher Kristen Korsgaard maintains that our treatment of other animals is a moral atrocity. But she also argues that non-human animals are not moral beings, that people are distinctive in being able to reflect upon their moral reasons and considerations and those of others. We're not just aware of things, we're aware that we're aware of them. We're uniquely aware, too, that others have independent interests and perspectives that may be worth respecting. So some philosophers will say that people who ascribe moralized emotions to their pets are indulging a sort of fiction. What's plainly not a fiction is that animals can suffer. The quality of the life of a dog or a cat is a matter of the quality of its moment-to-moment experiences. They have no projects to complete. Their lives have no narrative arc that matters to them. They don't fear death in the way we do. As far as we can tell, they don't have the concept of death. That's why the sorts of reasons a person might have for going on even after existence has become a source of pain don't apply to them. We can ask people whether they want to undergo an arduous treatment that might prolong their days by some amount or whether, say, they prefer to enter hospice care. Your mother and her sisters evidently faced a decision like that. That's not a question you can pose to your dog. What you owe your dog is a life worth living by the standards that are appropriate to a canine existence, attentive to what matters to a dog. So you shouldn't organize treatments that will simply extend a period of suffering, even if you can afford to do so without jeopardizing your own quality of life. Some people, hoping against hope, subject their animals to excruciating courses of radiation, chemotherapy, in an effort to buy a few more months of companionship. They ought to do what human beings are capable of doing, but often fail to do, reflect on their actions. They should think about whom they're really helping, about whether this costly form of care amounts to cruelty. If your dog is entering a final decline marked by debility and suffering, and out of concern for his welfare, you choose euthanasia, you will not be letting him down. He has no expectations to disappoint. There are no promises you've made to him. His loss will matter a great deal to you. Don't make the experience worse by thinking that you have done him wrong. And I'll read a the section Screenland. Why does the prison life content on TikTok feel so familiar? Cooking, life advice, bored, dancing, workout tips on social media. You're reminded that incarceration is a pretty common slice of American life. This is a story by Robin Kaiser Schatzein. In a recent video on TikTok, a suburban-looking mom called Marcy Marie walks into a suburban-looking kitchen. She has bleached blonde hair, a kind smile, sparkling eyes, and a warm Texas accent. "Hey, y'all," she says. "Today I want to show you guys how we made pizza in the penitentiary." She produced a bowl and begins. "The trickiest part," she says, "is getting your sauce right." She starts with ketchup as a base, adds a little V8 juice, and then thickens the mix with crushed potato chips. "Guys, the seasoning is the key," she says, adding garlic powder and minced onion. Next comes the dough, made by shredding slices of white bread into a potato chip bag and tipping in a little water. She works the bag with her hands, then unfurls it and pats the dough into a flat circle. "I'm going to show you how we fry that up with a hairdryer," she says. The images fast forward as she cuts vents in the side of a paper grocery bag, slides the crust in, clips the bottom, and inserts the hairdryer into a hole. She flips it on, and the bag inflates, becoming an ingeniously improvised air fryer. "You're going to want to fry that for about 10 minutes, she says. Later, she tops the crust with the sauce, cheese, Spam, and summer sausage, then returns it to the bag for another 20 minutes. "I haven't had prison pizza in a year and a half," she says, cutting up the dish with a plastic key card. "Looks like it turned out pretty great." Marcy Marie, perky and ebullient and ready to laugh at the odd compromises of prison cooking, takes the edge off what could be a mildly depressing variety of video. She's filmed herself cooking numerous prison dishes: coffee balls, cookie rolls, tater tots, chicken nachos, taffy, prison parfait. Beginning each video, much like any other TikTok home cooking instructional, "Let's make..." And she insists on authenticity, often preparing the dishes with the exact ingredients available on commissary: sandwich cookies, instant coffee, mashed potato flakes, powdered creamer, Coke. In the exact style she used while incarcerated, hair dryers and all. Each video is like a viral kitchen hack, only one the creator finds a little funny and sad and doesn't especially recommend. Others on the platform post similar videos. One demonstrates how to make a prison potato log, which is like a giant tamale. Another prepares a prison wrap, which is similar. There are even numerous cooking videos made by people who are still incarcerated, dishes cooked using methods that may or may not be prison legal, the process recorded on phones that most likely aren't. You can watch clips that appear to show people deep frying empanadas in a can, cooking eggs in a plastic bag, or grilling wraps on a metal bunk. The videos tend to be upbeat, and they're often tinged with nostalgia. Marcy Marie, for example, says the cookie rolls were a special treat made when someone had something to celebrate. The cooking is but a subset of the TikTok content made by formerly and currently incarcerated people. Some dedicate themselves to facing the camera and earnestly educating viewers about prison life, telling stories and answering questions. Marcy Marie has answered many, including, "Is it safe to make friends in prison?" "Yes," and responded to a message about how to iron clothes: soak in water, press with a cup or hot pot liquid lid, dry under your bed. Others describe the day of their release or how holidays were celebrated or the best form of burpees. The more you explore the prison life content on TikTok, the more it seems to mirror all the popular genres of the platform: cooking, life advice, bored dancing, working tips. Until life on the inside ceases to seem quite so distinct from life on the outside. America has no shortage of narratives about prison life, stretching from century-old memoirs and novels to recent film and television. But in recent decades, most of these depictions have centered on the most shocking aspects of higher security prisons. Reality and documentary shows, National Geographic's Lockdown, MSNBC's Lock Up, and A&E's Behind Bars, Netflix's I Am a Killer, focus often on exclusively on the worst, most dangerous facilities, highlighting escapes and riots and intense conflicts. Television dramas like Oz and Prison Break have done the same. America's incarcerated population has surged in the 1980s and 90s, but it wasn't until 2013's arrival of Netflix, Orange is the New Black, that television had any extended depiction of daily life in a minimum security prison. This focus on extreme conditions surely distorts our perception of prison life. We're shown hostile, alien, and debased environments, a different world with its own rules, as the intro to an episode of Behind Bars has it, filled with violent, dangerous people, killers, robbers, and rapists, per the intro to an episode of Lockdown. These terrifying conditions are undoubtedly real, but in the prisons being documented and in other ones. But when it comes to a system as a whole and life within it, they may not be wholly representative. The United States incarcerates people at a strikingly high rate, more by most estimates than any other nation on the planet. A majority of the 1.2 million people in our prisons are serving shorter sentences in lower security facilities, often for nonviolent crimes. Their daily experiences, even the grim ones, tend to go unremarked on in prison dramas, which pass over the grind of imprisonment, the glitchy, expensive video calls, the inedible food, the painful hours in solitary confinement, for a swirl of murder plots, escape plans, and sexual violence. But digital media excels at capturing the everyday, and this is the reality you can glimpse via all the online content made by incarcerated or formerly incarcerated people. It's not just the numerous accounts on TikTok. There's also today a podcast called Earl Ear Hustle, recorded partly from inside San Quentin Prison, in addition to the inmate-run San Quentin News, available online. Often this media depicts the terrifying human rights disaster we might have come to expect. But even when it does, we may also get to see the picture that sits beside that drama. Friendships, boredom, triumphs, pranks, improvised desserts. Far from making prison seem like a fun or tolerable place, these images accomplish something quietly disturbing. And then prison stops being a violent abstraction and becomes a place you could far more easily imagine yourself or someone you care about being unfortunate enough to end up. The best TikTok videos about prison life feel oddly like the best travel shows. When they're successful, they show you life elsewhere in a way that makes the subjects stop feeling like vague caricatures and become easier to relate to. As with so many travel shows, Marcy Marie's means of making this connection is food. She doesn't sensationalize her experience in a prison. Neither does she flatten it or package it neatly. Her demeanor is that of someone who assumes that her audience is interested in the details of how food was prepared in prison. Not because it's crazy, but because it is, for a great many people, normal. There's no lesson beyond the fact that life goes on in prison. And that, for all its surprises, is a slice of American life that often goes unexamined and unexpressed. It's a dark spot in our collective understanding of our own society, coming further into the light. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.